Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody, we've got a special treat just for our podcast subscribers. My friend Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and politics at Harvard University. But I met him when he was the head of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, which is this hugely important center here in New York, part of the New York Public Library. And he was convening all of these remarkable events and conversations there that I just loved. Anyway, now he's doing something similar on a podcast. He's got this cool new show called Some of My Best Friends Are, and you can probably guess from the name what it's all about. I talked with him recently about the show, and I'm going to share that conversation with you and also share an episode of his show that I really just loved and, frankly, that I think would have made a great episode of our show. So check it out. Khalil, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Kai, it's great to be here.
So you've got this wonderful new podcast, Some of My Best Friends Are, which, you know, is a great tease for what the show is about. I love that sort of trailer, Some of My Best Friends Are. But it's you and it's journalist Ben Austin in these intimate conversations about, I guess, the lived experience of race and racism in America.
Yeah.
And so first off, who is Ben Austin to you?
Yes, Ben Austin is my best bud. We've known each other for 35 years.
35 years,
yeah. We met when I was 14. He's a year older than me, but we were both freshmen in high school, and we met at a job, actually. Mm. You know, I was kind of like the Doogie Howser of early computing, and so I needed some help.
I love it.
Yeah, I was selling computers to like University of Chicago faculty and a whole bunch of other people who were making the shift from word processors to IBM PC compatibles. And so Ben and I got to know each other both at work, and we ended up being tennis players together. We played high school tennis, and we've been best friends ever since.
And we have to say for the purpose of this conversation, Ben is white.
Yes, Ben is white. He's Jewish. He's born and raised in Chicago in Hyde Park, where we grew up. And it's important to say also that he is a professional journalist. And so his qualifications for this show and conversations aren't just who he is in our relationship. He spent a lot of time thinking and writing about these issues.
Right. But so the point is, it's the two of you as a Black person and him as a white Jewish person, sort of talking across these racial lines about stuff. And has that always been part of your dynamic and your friendship since you were 14 years old? Have you guys sort of always been sitting around, were you kids sitting around talking about race and racism?
Actually, just the opposite, to be honest with you. I mean, we both sort of grew into our own individual political consciousness and then made professional choices that, you know, sort of bring us to this moment. But the thing that the show is sort of built on is trust and authenticity. And that's rare because, you know, you can ask people, have you had a Black friend, if it's a white person, or if it's a white person, have you had an Asian friend? I mean, you know, people have these experiences, generally speaking, but they usually burn out, right? People grow apart and they don't last. And so for us, part of it is like, it is going on four decades. And we grew closer. We grew closer, not just out of the lived experiences of being a Black and a white guy in an integrated middle-class community in Chicago, but we actually chose careers that made our work even more relevant to our personal relationship.
Listening to the show, I've heard you guys kind of joke about the way each of you sort of performed racial identity as teenagers, which I think about that a lot myself. It's part of growing up in America, right? Learning your relationship
That's
to
right.
this fiction, right?
That's right.
But it's kind of, yeah. I guess it's interesting to hear you guys acknowledge it to each other, though, and not make it a thing, you know? I mean, it's...
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be honest, too. I mean, it wasn't really until doing the show that we really kind of leaned into those differences. I mean, I was listening to Culture Club, Phil Collins, and Madonna. I had Steve Winwood in my, like, a little cassette in my Hyundai, my little three-door Hyundai that I was driving around back then. And Ben was listening to Boogie Down Productions. He was wearing a gold chain. He was definitely cooler than me. I mean, he's kind of a tall, good-looking guy. I'm short and a little bit nerdy back in the day. I got all of my girlfriends through him and his girlfriend, who were like, yeah, we're just cool people. And so, yeah, it totally inverts it. You know, I think today I'm cooler, actually, but back in the day, he would have won the cool contest.
I don't know, Khalil. Maybe he's still cooler.
Well, if you listen to the show, he certainly tries to portray that by teasing me as the Harvard professor.
Right. So why do you want to make this show now? I mean, you are a Harvard professor. You are a busy and quite accomplished guy. I can't imagine you need more work. Why was this important for you right now?
You know, I think that for me in particular, I have spent the last 10 years of my career searching for different ways to communicate why the history of this nation needs serious reckoning and attention. And it started with being an assistant professor, writing a book at Indiana University, and getting a job at the Schomburg Center, which was totally unexpected and unplanned. But it thrust me into the position of leading this nearly century-old cultural institution, where all of a sudden I was at the center of not only this historic Black community, the capital of Black America, and holding this space that was kind of a town hall. It was the Black public sphere. And I recognized that in that space, there was a lot of opportunity to increase people's awareness and understanding, to bridge the gap between scholarship and public knowledge. And so this, to me, this opportunity to do a podcast with my best friend was an opportunity to take all those lessons from running the Schomburg Center and being very publicly facing and saying, this is another way to do that kind of work, but to do it with a journalist, to do it with someone who's authentic and someone who has both lived experience as knowledge as well as learned experience.
And you guys, you end the conversation, you end your episodes saying, I love you to each other, which feels intentional.
No, it is intentional, but it's not a prop. I mean, meaning that we were doing that already, I mean, to be honest with you. But we intentionally carried it into the show because, you know, we are two dudes, right? We both happen to be cis men married to women. And we wanted some way to model that part of our authenticity is also our vulnerability, which is our emotional connection to each other. And, you know, there's a lot of bros on YouTube and doing podcasts, and we thought this was a way to bring our full selves to this work.
Well, in the context of the kind of conversations you're having, too, is where it struck me, you know? I mean, you don't hear love, sadly, you don't hear love often talked about when people are talking across racial lines about race.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, like, we wanted to invite listeners into both, like, here is a conversation you're probably not having yourself, but you should be having. And if you've had a relationship with someone who you thought was your best friend or who you claimed as a best friend, but you couldn't actually have the full gamut of conversations and love this person fully, then you're not being authentic. You're not taking the risks that are required for us actually to do the individual things we can do to lean into a better country.
Yeah. So we're going to share an episode of your podcast with our podcast listeners that I'm particularly interested in, and in part because you kind of beat me to the punch on booking this one. but it's you.
It won't happen that often, Kai. Your show is amazing. So don't worry. Don't worry. You know, if it just happened this time, then it's just a fluke.
Well, you saved me the work, you know?
Yes.
But it's you and Ben talking with author J. Caspian King about his new book, The Loneliest Americans. So first off, quickly, what's that book about and why'd you guys want to talk with him?
Yeah, so the book is about Jay kind of iconoclastically questioning this label, this category of Asian American, And so the first thing, you know, the reader needs to know is we're talking about a heterogeneous population that is huge, not only in the billions, but represents people who actually were born here generations ago and those who just arrived more recently or who are, like himself, the children of immigrants. So he wanted to complicate the way that we're moving into a greater recognition of this population. They're the fastest growing demographic. And then things like, you know, huge stratification. So we talk about the black-white disparities, but within communities of Asian descent, from Laotians to Vietnamese to Cambodians, all the way to Japanese, Korean, and Chinese Americans, are huge economic disparities that are greater than, say, within the black community or between whites and blacks. And so that's just the context, I think, for why Jay wrote this book. And the book is very much a personal. It is about the choices he made. It's about how he came of age. He talks about sort of identifying himself along the lines of understanding black people. In other words, he says, you know, I came to understand who I was as an Asian guy because of my proximity to blackness and not so much because of what I thought about white people or what they thought about me.
You know, and this is, I've always enjoyed reading J. Caspian Kang's work because you get to follow along as he's kind of publicly been wrestling with this and wrestling with his own racial and ethnic identities for some time. Yep. And one of the big points here is that, you know, he's also come to think that the broader category we throw around of people of color is not real. And I'll confess that I have the same feeling often, even though I do kind of casually use it often myself. I wonder how that idea hit you.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate the nuance. I mean, he tells this great story about how he understood a friend of his, a childhood friend, as a black guy who was low income and treated with a much more disdain and sort of ostracized and stigmatized for his poverty. And he says, like, you know, that's a black experience. That's what it means to be stigmatized as a person of color. You know, I take issue with Jay in this way. I would say that people of color should not be simply reserved for people experiencing the worst kind of racial stigma and oppression in society, which I think that's what it collapses into. He wants to escape from that term because he thinks it ought to be reserved for people who are really suffering. So I don't know where I'm going to land on this people of color term. Mm. I tend to be a big tent guy anyway, and so I don't usually get my feathers ruffled over this kind of term. I know the gesture is a meaningful one towards solidarity, but I think for Jay, he wants people to be more accountable to what solidarity actually means and not for it to be just performative. I think that's what's really bothering him. Yeah. We haven't resolved this tension in our language. I think we are in that moment. But of course, if we've got John McWhorter in our head, like I do sometimes, you know, it's like, well, do we really want to talk about this or do we want to talk about all the shit that people put up with?
Well, John McWhorter is a conversation for another show. So we will put
I'm
a
sorry.
Pin in that, or maybe I'll just wait
I'm
for
sorry.
Your episode on it. But for now, dear listener, I invite you to listen to this coming episode of Khalil and Ben talking with J. Caspian Kang about all of this stuff and see what you think for yourself. Give it a listen.
All right, so I'm going to lead us off with the first question. Is that good?
Right, go ahead.
You good, Jay? You ready? All right. So what happens when a white guy, a black guy, and an Asian guy get together and talk about identity?
I don't know. Maybe the white guy is very quiet usually.
All right. That's good. That's good. I'm Khalil Gibran Muhammad.
And I'm Ben Austin. We're two best friends.
One black.
One white.
I'm a historian.
And I'm a journalist.
And this is Some of My Best Friends Are.
In this show, we wrestle with the challenges
and the absurdities
of a deeply divided and unequal country.
And in this episode, we deepen our understanding of that divide by talking with J. Caspian Kang about his new book, The Loneliest Americans.
Khalil, we've been thinking for a while. How do we do an episode of this show of Some of My Best Friends Are that is about the Asian American experience.
Yeah, yeah. I we have talked about this a lot. And I'm like, why don't we talk about all our Asian American best friends?
Yeah, and I was worried that was going to be like, man, we sound like that, the joke of the show's title. And you were like, yeah, yeah, but that's okay. So then J. Caspian Kang's book came out, The Loneliest That's Americans.
Right. Yep. And I remember you were like, dude, we should talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I've been following his work for more than a decade, right? Like, I remember he used to write for this website called Grantland, which I also wrote for. Mm-hmm. He worked for Vice News as a civil rights reporter.
Yep.
He wrote for the New York Times Magazine.
Which we've both written for, but yes.
Oh, okay. All right. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, and he writes this newsletter now for the New York Times, which is so smart and funny and kind of offbeat at the same time.
It's part of the race-related series, right?
Yeah, yeah. So this was it seems so connected to what we're doing. And also controversial in a way. Like this book, I think, The Loneliest Americans, takes a stance that has actually, like, he's got some backlash on.
Yeah.
So we got him on the show. He joined us from his home in Northern California.
Yeah, so let's get into it.
Just generally for listeners, the book is about the identity of Asian people in America. And I'm careful to not say Asian American because you talk about how that identity doesn't exist.
Right.
And sort of you challenge that sense. And we wanted to invite you on the show because we read this book and it felt so much in dialogue with this show, which is called Some of My Best Friends Are, and is, you know, about race in all these ways, and also with our lives, because the show is really about, you know, we're wrestling with these stories too.
Mm-hmm. We are the white black binary.
Yeah. Right? And like
embodied.
And this sense, like you write about this white black binary, and that, you know, the white part sort of embodying assimilation and upward mobility, and the black part a sense of either like victimization and racial struggle, and that there wasn't really a place for you personally, and also not a place for most Asians in America.
Right.
Yep.
Certainly my parents were never like, how's it going navigating space? Or like, you know, how does it feel to be, you know, in these classrooms, or like, you know, what's going on in there? And man, I mean, like, thinking about your book and thinking about, like, we went back to our high school yearbook after reading your book because...
Yeah, Jay, I brought it out just for man. God. You know, like, it looks like a chessboard, right?
Yeah.
It's like black, white, black, white. That's
wow.
it.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like one white kid on each page. Every
no,
girl has
not
the
true.
Exact
that's
same.
I'm seeing, five white kids per page at least.
Way more
well,
white
not,
kids.
That's not
right
the
now
page.
A that, blonde kid right in the middle of it.
Exactly. And more particularly, I mean, to Ben's larger point, I mean, because your book inspired so much of our own thinking about like seeing ourselves like across this vast spectrum of how we understand whiteness and blackness, I literally went back and counted like how many students could I identify as part of an Asian diaspora, and I couldn't get to two hands.
Oh wow. How big was the school?
Almost 2,000.
I'm pretty sure our class was
about
500.
Oh wow.
Yeah,
wow.
500.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe we could first start about the three of us all growing up mostly in the 1980s, and thinking about how we all learned that binary existed. Like, this is sort of the main racial divide, and you have to fit somewhere in it.
Right, right. I split my childhood between Cambridge, Massachusetts, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, two university towns. And in Cambridge, you know, after a few years, we moved out to the suburbs. I think I was in first or second grade, and this one of my first clear memories is that, you know, watching the kids get off the Metco bus, you know, like when we had moved to the suburbs, just all black, you know, it's just black kids probably from Roxbury or South Boston.
You got to tell us a little something about Metco because, you know, it's sort of this dream experiment that people brag about as
they
like.
Brag about it. Wow. Metco is the Boston area busing program, right? And it was seen as this great beacon of progressive thought. And it was a huge infrastructure thing where they would bus kids 30, 40 minutes out into the suburbs, and that it was basically the peak of like school integration goodwill, right? And one of the first memories I have from my childhood period is just sort of standing at the bus circle and, you know, watching the Mudco bus roll in. And every kid who got off the bus was black, and there are no black kids at the rest of the school. Like, maybe there's one or two, but almost none. I don't think that I was really aware that I was, like, much different than the white kids, you know, because I lived in that town, right? Like, I didn't take that bus. And so the differentiator of race in that instance was whether or not you took the bus, right? That was the first time I thought I actually realized that there was any difference, you know, and standing in the bus circle there and just sort of, you know, because it was so stark, right? Like, it was just like, those kids ride that bus. I don't ride that bus, right? And so I must be part of this group.
So then you move from Cambridge, Massachusetts to the South to Chapel Hill, I believe, right, in North Carolina. What was that school like?
My schooling was very similar to yours. You know, there weren't that many Asian kids around, and the school had a lot of black students and a lot of white students, you know. You know, there's this really interesting class element to it, too, where I was in this very odd program back then, and it was like 18 of us. I hate people who say this, but it's like some sort of like accelerated program. But we had three black kids in that class, and one of their fathers was like the most famous doctor in the area. Like, you know, like on local news when the doctor comes on, right?
Yep. Like Sanjay Gupta.
Right. So he was
for local television.
In the Piedmont area, he was sort of the Sanjay Gupta. And then the other girl in our class, her father was an educator. The mother was like, I think worked in STEM. And then we had one kid who was from the sort of, you know, the poor black neighborhood in Chapel Hill. And it was interesting how like that was even differentiated, even for us in fifth grade. Right.
You mean you understood these black kids were different from each other?
Right. It was more ingrained in us to think of it that way than it would be to think of it as being like totally separated. Right. And it made for a very confusing experience that I tried to write about in the book, where it's just like, you know, like, how do you sort of sort all this, especially when, you know, you're in the situation where you have to differentiate.
But I mean, it's an interesting point about how you're also navigating the absurdities of racial stereotypes that you can see black people are also trying to traverse, challenge, avoid. And you tell this great story about Dwayne, a friend of yours, who you befriended. Was that also in
Yeah,
Chapel
it's
Hill?
The same kid who was in that class who lived in that
Okay, so we're talking right? about yeah, Dwayne. Yeah. Yeah, he's the poor kid. Yeah. You make the point about Dwayne as the poor kid in the community being kind of representative of the absurdity of this notion of people of color all being the same.
Oh, yeah. If someone had told me that we were both people of color, I would just look at them like they're crazy, you know, because there was such separation between me and Dwayne, right? And, you know, in the book, I sort of illustrated through this anecdote where like our Little League games or some of our Little League games were played in Dwayne's neighborhood. And if you can imagine how, you know, this is still the South. Chapel Hill's progressive town is still the South, right? And the way in which people would talk about going to those games, right? Lock your car, you know, like make sure that like get in and out as quickly as possible, all this sort of stuff.
This kind of anti-black, everyone's a criminal rhetoric.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a kid, you absorb that, right? And so then you were playing and Dwayne walks over the field. He sees me. He says hello. You know, this is another moment where I just like sort of understand that seeing him in that environment, you see like, oh, what they're talking about when they say lock your cars and get out of there as quickly as possible is Dwayne, right?
Yeah.
Right. And so the idea at that moment that like you and Dwayne are people of color, like what are you talking about, you know? And I don't know, I've thought about that moment so much throughout my life where it's just like you know, because in some ways I felt like I was betraying him, right? Because I was acting so awkward, and that it was shocking to me. I was like probably 12 years old, something like that, and I'm having these thoughts, right, about my friend. And I mean it's tough to talk about even now, you know, and the reality of it is that I think if you said that Deirdre and I, you know, who was a woman whose father was like our famous doctor, if you had said Deirdre and you are people of color, I would have been sure, you know, but Dwayne and I could not be people of color together. And I think that that's like a very complicated thing that I think that those types of distinctions are very uncomfortable, but, you know, in my life, at least, they're much more felt. Like, you know, like they seem much more real to me than terms like people of color.
You struggle with the term people of color throughout most of the book. And I've been thinking, is there a moment when you really come to terms with who you are? Because that seems to me to be a question at the heart of this book. Who am I?
Right. That's true. Well, I think it was a series of moments. And I think what's interesting about the series of moments, and maybe this is not typical for Asian people, but it certainly was true for me, was that none of the moments had anything to do with white people, right? Of course, it, in some ways, it had to do with white people, but it was not about differentiating myself from white people or having white people differentiate themselves from me, right? It was about every single one of these moments involved black people, right? It involved either differentiating myself from black people or having black people differentiate themselves from me.
Wow.
And I think that that actually is, you know, has informed basically all of my thinking, right? And that this went through a lot of phases. Like when I was 16, 17, maybe 15, like I wore Timberlands and listened to Wu-Tang and Nas. And
oh, snap. You're getting close to Ben. You're pushing up on the white right, guy in this conversation.
I was like, I wonder, you're pushing up on that guy. Ben can identify.
He has some stories to tell.
I'm more KRS-One. I'm a little
right,
bit older.
Right. Yeah. But it was like, you know, like... I feel like people who are about our age and a little bit older are much more familiar with this than young people today, because I think it's sort of been drummed out of the culture. But there's a period where like a lot of Asian kids, a lot of Jewish kids, I think, would sort of put on this affect when they're teenagers, right? Or maybe, and I sometimes I argue, look, I don't know if it's even an affect, right? It's just like you're developing, and this is a path that you chose. You chose this type of identification. And I definitely went through all of that, right? And so you swing back and forth, right? But what was interesting to me at the time, or you know, now that I think about it, is like I don't know, Ben. Why did you like what was
thank
your
you, yeah, Jay. Ben, thank
Ben,
you because
I actually because am much sitting, more curious
he's,
about
he's
you.
Literally let he's Jay literally ask, the white ask. Guy in this conversation right. being silent, like you said at the
right,
beginning.
Right, Ben.
Of this
what's
episode.
The what was that like for you? Like what was your experience with that?
The what is like in terms of identity?
Right. Or? No, like in high school, like where you did you listen to rap and like sort of. Talk with
yeah, that. Listen to rap. I mean, like Khalil and I joke because he was more like Phil Collins and I was more like
KRS-One. Why are you talking about me? You got to talk about
no,
yourself.
No, I'm embracing it. You know, so the dominant culture was, you know, which I felt a part of. Like, I mean, I was sort of like, you know, saturated by this world and like, you know, connected to it in a lot of ways. You know, Khalil had been asking me after reading this book about being Jewish in that world. And I was sort of thinking about that in my head, and like there wasn't like an alternative white dominant culture that I felt that I, you know, was vacillating between, right. You know, like between say white and black and then a third thing Jewish, you know, that there just, it didn't exist in any numbers in our community. So I could be
I can
this,
think of a whole lot of corny white dudes who you
no,
could
but,
follow,
but that doesn't behind. Mean exactly. That doesn't mean that it's
did
dominant.
Did you have like a, like, did you feel like not totally white? At the time either, because like that was it, you know, in North Carolina, my friends were mostly Jewish. There weren't that many of them, you know. And I think about it, it's like this is like the 80s and 90s. It's like they weren't exactly white back then either, you know. Like
that's a great question. You know, what's funny about that, I would say that I didn't think that at all in high school. And then when I went to college and I was like amidst this all white culture, I was like, man, I'm not really like all these white people.
Right. Mm.
And I didn't think in those terms beforehand. You know, I thought I was just this thing that existed in this space.
Right.
And then being in an all-white space, essentially, a college, and people who didn't grow up in communities and neighborhoods like I did, I was like, man, I'm not like these white people.
Right.
And that had less to do with being Jewish than with sort of just coming from a certain neighborhood.
Right.
Well, what I can tell you, Jay, in clearer terms, is that this dude was black cool in high school. he carried himself in a way that, you know, had swagger. He wore a gold chain. I to this day I've never owned a gold chain.
He had his
Jerbo jeans. I was still wearing.
Well, who didn't wear Jerbo jeans? Come on.
Yeah, well I had
come
like
on,
one
you
pair,
didn't have Jerbo jeans.
And so if I showed you pictures of him back then, you would totally get it.
Yeah. Many so of my that's, friends that's were, the, were exact, you know, were like that. It's an interesting thing because I feel like there's a lot of sort of shame, right? It's not like people like are going to cancel you, get mad at you if you did that, yeah. But certainly.
Unless you actually put on blackface,
right,
then you're done.
Right, but it's very, it's thought of as very gauche now. And I don't know, like, yeah. do you get that? Do you think it's gauche now? Or do you, and like, how do you reflect back on it and think about like, hey, you know, like, no, I was right, you know?
No, I don't feel it because I don't feel like I was pretending to be something I wasn't either.
Right.
I think I was aware of the cultures around me and also, you know, engaged in it. And so, yeah, the menu of options was there and I like picked from those menu items, you know, like of the six items, I picked five of them. And one of them, as Khalil said, it might've been like, you know, white kid on the math team and I didn't pick that one. When we come back after the break, we're gonna talk to Jay about choices he made to focus his reporting on Black Lives Matter protests and the choices Asians in America can make about their future.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
You write a lot about your reporting on the Black Lives Matter protests, mm-hmm. which is something that I also did a lot of reporting on here in Chicago after the killing of Laquan McDonald and sort of like I got deep into this here. And, you know, what drew you to that reporting and sort of like what did you learn about yourself by covering this racial justice moment?
Well, you know, since I was in high school or college, I thought that I still feel this way, you know, like I'm very drawn to protest movements, especially, you know, street protests. It's like the thing that I feel most passionately about, right? And so during Ferguson and for the 4 years after, like that was basically my job.
Yeah, you were the, quote, civil rights reporter for
right,
Vice.
Right, right. I did some Vice stuff News, for the Times and then my job for Vice was, you know, just go and, you know, see what's happening. And as a result, I went to tons of these protests, right? Like Baton Rouge, Minneapolis, Baltimore, St. Louis.
Yeah, Alton Sterling right, Freddie
right,
Gray.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. And you write a lot about Philando Castile.
Philando Castile, yeah. Right. You know, it felt like at first I was just like, well, at a lot of them I'd be like, well, I'm the only Asian person here, you know? And like, what's going on here?
You count the faces, right?
Right, so, yeah, right. I would just count.
Well, one more thing before you say that. So I learned for the first time that Asian people, at least you, give the nod. I was like, holy shit, like, there's an Asian nod, right? Isn't it what you say?
Right, yeah. I mean, I think I have protests in, like, 2017 or 2016. Yeah, definitely. But last summer, there was much more Asian people out for George Floyd. But, you know, prior to that, I would see very few, you know, and people can argue with me or whatever, but I was at all of these, you know, and I was looking mm-hmm. and I didn't see many. And it really did sort of form a lot of my thinking over the last 5 years, right? It was just like, well, what is all this? What is like sort of the public face of what people say Asian American identity is within like the press, right? They say, oh, well, it's like a radical political identity. It's like, you know, like we're allies, we're fellow people of color, right? And I'd be like, well, where are you? You know, like, like, why are you not showing up? Where are all of you? And, you know, it made me realize that, like, the people who say those things are saying them in earnest. And I bet a lot of them did go to a lot of those protests, you know, but it's a very small population. And the vast majority of Asian America are people who are either recent immigrants or people who are apolitical, right? And yeah, I don't know. I think it's difficult to make the argument that the people who sort of think of Asian American identity as like this progressive people of color thing are in any way the majority. They're just, you know, they just happen to be the people who get to talk and define that thing. And that realization, I think, has been like the most formative for my political beliefs, at least, right? Which is just like, maybe we don't have to think about this stuff. Maybe it's more important to show up and you know, like within the space of the protest, like all these things will be resolved. You can make connections, you can talk to people, you can organize with people. And that if you show up, 99% of the people there are not going to worry about, you know, your relative privilege or, you know, where you fit on a racial hierarchy scale at all, right? Like they're happy you showed up. And I think that that's a message I tried to put in the book, because I think a lot of people, a lot of Asian Americans like myself who, you know, went to good schools and are upwardly mobile, I think they just need to hear it. You know, like, stop, don't worry about it, just show up.
Yeah, Jay, this is really fascinating. I mean, you know, I teach at Harvard and I see these kids. I mean, and they, many of them were born here. Some of them are new to the country. Yeah. But to your point about feeling uncomfortable with this notion of a shared people of color identity is a very real thing. And I think your book does a good job of that. I think it would be helpful for me, though, to understand, like, how before 1965, for those immigrants, as compared to the kids we're talking about that I teach, or yourself, or the people you want to show up at these protests, how should we understand this difference between before 1965 and after 1965?
Yeah, so in the 1960 census, there's like something like 800,000 people who are called Asians in this country, right? And many of them have been here for generations, right? And the reason why there's not more is because it's, you know, there's exclusion laws. It's basically impossible to immigrate from Asia to the United States. And so you have this community, like a lot of them have been interned, right, by the time the 60s roll around. And it's a small community. They've direct links back to a lot of the campaigns of like racial terror that were inflicted upon Chinese people. All this stuff happened.
Yep.
And then what you have in 1965, you had the Hartzell-Ohr Immigration Act, and now you have more than 20 million Asian people in America.
And the fastest growing population.
Fast growing population, people from all sorts of countries, right, coming in. You know, the boundaries of what Asian America is expand every single day, right? And you have populations that people don't even know about, right? Hmong population, or you have like a Laotian populations. And, you know, if you ask people on the street, what's Asian, what does Asian American mean? They're mostly going to just say Chinese, Japanese, or whatever, right? Maybe sometimes Korean.
Or Korean.
And so the boundaries are have expanded just drastically since then. And so one of the questions that I ask is just like, the history that those people prior to 1965 defined themselves through, internment, exclusion, right? Does it really have that much relevance to the people who came post-1965? Do the stories from the past have any relevance to the masses of people who come afterwards? And how do they think about themselves in America, right? And I think they think about themselves in America very differently. I think they're much more like my parents, who are just sort of like, put your head down, work, you know, don't think about it. You're in America now, you know, try and fit in and try and be successful, right? And these are the ways that you can be successful. We can't help you all that much, you know, because we don't know, we have no social capital here, right? And so what's strange is that there's now this disconnect where the way that Asian American history is told, or Asian American identity is formed, is very much based in things like the Chinese Exclusion Act, right? Like you saw when the women got killed in the spa in Atlanta, like everybody's doing threads about Asian American history, right? And it's about internment, stuff like that. And my thought is always just like, I'm not, that stuff is bad, you know? Like it was like a regime of white terror against Asian people, right?
Yeah.
What does that really have like a full on connection with people who have no lineage to that at all, right? And so I think that's sort of the point that I try and make in the book, which is just like, this is a pretty formless group of people at this point, right? And that they can really be anything. But what the thing that they're not really is like a fully formed people in any sort of way.
Yeah.
Right. They're not cohesive. Yeah. Because I think to your point, the assimilationist imperatives of post-65 immigrants, the ones who are coming today, I agree with you, creates this huge knowledge vacuum. And I think part of what you're writing about in this book is kind of what that means for justice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll say, like, you know, the book is fascinating and the storytelling is amazing. Your mom on trips taking out the phone book and looking for Korean names.
Right, right.
And then actually calling those people and then like getting together with
right,
them.
Right, right. Yeah. They were just like sort of asking like, hey, are you all right here? You know, I'm just being like, I don't, you know, that's, Yeah, it was definitely a cringe moment for me and my sister. You know, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But now that I'm older, I understand it much better. You know, she must have felt very unsettled when my dad dragged us all out to like the, you know, the barrens of the West every summer, being like,
right, gonna, this was like Wyoming, right?
Wyoming, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota. Like, it's our only vacations. Like, we didn't go to, I don't know, normal vacations.
Man, I love your parents. but can we talk about you as a parent? You also open and close the book writing about your daughter. Mm-hmm. And your daughter is biracial. Your wife is white. And I'll also make a plug, half Jewish.
Right.
And also my children are biracial. And it is such an interesting sort of, you know, opening up to identity, because you don't share a certain kind of identity with the person who is closest to you in the world.
Right.
And so there's a lot of reflection that causes, and maybe early on, because later you're just like, I'm just trying to deal with being a parent. But early on, like where you are, like you're deep in it, thinking these thoughts, like, will my child have an experience that is different than mine?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the emotional core of the book, right? It's sort of a rumination on why did this happen to me, you know, and other Asian people? And then what's the future going to look like, right, now that people are on this path of assimilation, or if they are on this path of assimilation? And who are the people who are not on the path of assimilation? What are their lives going to look like? And so for my daughter, I think about it, and like, you know, we live here in the East Bay, and, you know, there's a ton of half-Asian kids running around, right? And she goes to a school where there are way more half-Asian kids than there were Asian kids, period, in any school I ever went to. And there are a lot of Asian kids, too, right? And I remember the teacher at some point, you know, this is, I think, during Pride Week or something like that, like, said to me, you know, she's like, I just want to raise, like, a bunch of allies, right? Like, I want these kids to be allies. And it was very, you know, like in my head, it kind of fucked me up, because I was like, ally. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like, I am not white, you know, like if somebody had told me, like, you know, like, you need to be an ally, I'd be like, listen, you know, like, I'm not white, you know, like, let me tell you, like,
you need to ally with me.
Right. My childhood was like not great, you know, like, because I am not white, you know. But then I think about it, just like, maybe she's right, you know, like, maybe, you know, I'm sure, Ben, you had these thoughts too, where it's just like, is the stuff that I write, you know, is the stuff that I think about, I talk about in myself, is it going to be relatable to her, right? Like, is she going to think about things in the same way?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. You have such a contrarian persona online.
Right.
and you know, I mean, maybe that is inherently part of you, but it also feels, you know, it's so forward on everything you post. And that, as you said, is like this emotional core and rawness and openness. You know, it has none of that.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I was thinking, though, that I mean, your dilemma, which you're so expressive about, you know, because you're like, you know, I don't want my daughter to be entitled, you know, I don't want to raise a spoiled kid. I mean, these are your words, right? And it seems to me, like, Ben and I have talked about this on this show a lot, but we as parents do make a choice. We make a choice about what we teach our kids about the world we live in. And, you know, I'm wondering, just as a final reflection, like, are you teaching your daughter the things that you're writing about? Because that seems to me to be a very different reality for her than what happened to you when your parents didn't talk to you about these things.
Well, she's about to turn 5, and so it's right about the time when these conversations start. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, I think so, you know. And I think that I would like her to be aware of it in a way. Now, if she turns into like your sort of stereotypical, like, you know, bleeding heart liberal Berkeley kid, I'd be overjoyed, you know, like I'd be so happy, you know. But yeah, you know, here in Berkeley, we have a huge homeless population, right? And, you know, like, does not understand why people live in tents, right? And those conversations are starting. I had a friend come over at some point, and I probably shouldn't tell this story, but it's kind of a little funny, you know, but I had a friend come
we
over
like a little funny.
In the middle of the pandemic, and no one had been in our house in a long time. And one of the first people to come to our house was one of my friends who's black. And she goes, like, he walks in and she says, he's black. And I was like, whoa, you know, like, and like, it wasn't because she had not been around black people before, you know, but I think that she had been learning at school that there was this, you know, like, because they learn about civil rights movement and everything like that. And I think that it had been this moment where she like was starting to differentiate people. And, you know, when we lived in New York, we lived in Crown Heights, you know, she goes to preschool, everything like that, where like, you know, like 30-40% of the kids in her class are black. And so it's not like she had not been around black people before, but it was this moment where, you know, something had clicked in her head. And so, yeah, we had a talk then too, you know, but it's
Jay, that's such a beautiful story because, you know, for me as a parent, my kids are older. My wife and I committed very early on to teaching them, but even we made mistakes. And by that, I mean, we didn't talk about Asians.
Right.
Like, we talked about black, white. And the consequences of that was that we were living, my youngest daughter was born in Indiana. We were living in a community with a large population of Asian students, many of whom were immigrant students. And one day, babysitter has our like four-year-old kid on the bus, the campus bus, which was not a common experience for her, but she's on a campus bus and she turns to her babysitter and says, why are there so many Asian people on this bus?
Right.
So, you know, like that's an invitation, right? To parenting and to having a conversation. We are just so grateful for you spending time with us today. And we're going to count you among our best friends, Jay. So thanks for spending time with us.
This is amazing, Jay.
Oh, thank good. You so much. No, this is great.
I think talking to him, I appreciated so much his openness with us and how experiences from his childhood are still, he's still processing them. And, you know, I feel the same way. I feel the same way about my past. Like it's still, I'm still wrestling with different ideas and thinking about it.
Wrestling with.
No doubt.
We need to talk about that some more.
but I also think like if the book was only his personal individual experiences, it wouldn't work. Right? Mm-hmm. Like he's just one person, but he tells this story about himself. And it is a kind of coming of age story and a coming of age story racially, but also an intellectual coming of age story because he tells a story of thinking, you know, he cakes all this personal stuff in history and research and other flashpoint moments that are really important for an Asian community in the United States.
I think that works, but I think the word I would use would not be intellectual. I think it would be political.
Okay.
One of the things that stuck out to me is when he talked about both in the book and a little bit in our conversation that, you know, who is really speaking for the people working in low wage retail, nail salons, laundering, restaurants today, who's really speaking for them? And what he's basically saying is in my community, not a whole lot of us.
Yeah. And he's saying their politics don't align necessarily, but like we have to find this common ground. And that to me, that was a really powerful part of the book.
That is an especially powerful part of the book because that's so much about what you and I are really committed to. We're committed to the work that we do individually and this show collectively because these issues that we face should be all of ours to tackle.
Jay opens the book by saying he's not going to provide all the answers, but he really is going to engage with a lot of these questions. And he totally succeeds in that. Like I am deeply immersed in this topic now from reading the book and thinking about it a lot and wrestling with these questions. And I definitely recommend people to dive into this book as well.
Yeah. And the truth is that probably for the first time in many ways, I am much more sensitive to and aware of many more communities that I need to care as much about as I care about my own. And I think that's really, that's a value to the book. So.
Yeah, that's a powerful point.
All right, man. Love you.
Love you too.
Some of My Best Friends Are is a production of Pushkin Industries. The show is written and hosted by me, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, and my best friend, Ben Austin.
It's produced by Cher Vincent and edited by Karen Shakurji. Our engineer is Martin Gonzalez. Our associate editor is Keishel Williams. Our associate producer is Lucy Sullivan. And our showrunner is Sasha Mathias.
Our executive producers are Lita Molad and Mia LaBelle.
Special thanks to Jay Caspian Kang. He's our newest best friend. And you should check out his book, The Loneliest Americans, and also subscribe to his New York Times newsletter.
At Pushkin, thanks to Heather Fain, Carly Migliori, John Schnars, and Jacob Weisberg.
Our theme song, Little Lily, is by fellow Chicagoan Avery R. Young from his amazing album, Tubman. You will definitely want to check out more of his music at his website, averyryoung.com.
You can find Pushkin on all social platforms at Pushkin Pods, and you can sign up for our newsletter at pushkin.fm. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen.
If you love Some of My Best Friends Are and any of the other shows from Pushkin Industries, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus.
Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted listening for $4.99 a month.
Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And I just want to say, Khalil, you just proved that argument about somebody who's connected to Harvard will bring it up in the first 15 minutes of the conversation. You were like, because I work now in Cambridge.
I didn't actually say
no,
Harvard.
That's
to be fair, I brought it up first. Right?
See, it's what little you know about Cambridge has more than just Harvard. How about that?
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.